papers, pulling out boxes of microfilm. Then she dug the scuffed cowboy boots into the carpet and rolled herself, still seated, across the room. She stopped in front of an enormous machine that must have represented cutting-edge technology around the time that story was written in 1979. Jessica kicked one boot absent-mindedly against a metal cabinet as she threaded the film and began to fast-forward. Minutes passed. You could practically hear the machine groan with the effort of dredging up names that had lain forgotten for so long. At last, the correct edition came into focus. The story bore a simple headline: Buckhead couple shot, killed. She zoomed in, and we began to read. Atlanta. A Delta Airlines pilot and his wife were shot and killed Tuesday afternoon in their Buckhead home, and authorities said they were searching for clues as to why the couple may have been attacked. Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith, both 26, were shot sometime after 3 p.m., Atlanta police said. This may have been a robbery that escalated into a shooting, said Lieutenant Steve Meadows, commander of the Atlanta Police Department's homicide unit. We're working all angles right now. Investigators had made no arrests as of Tuesday night, Meadows said. He urged the public to come forward with tips about the shooting on Eulalia Road, just south of Peachtree Road in northeast Atlanta. Jessica bit her lip. You said you needed this for personal reasons? Did you know them? I had a hard lump in my throat. They were my parents. She jerked around in her chair and stared at me in horror. Your parents? Yeah. Jesus Christ. I'm so sorry. It's okay. I mean, obviously it's not okay. But I was really young. I don't remember it. I coughed. I grew up somewhere else and only just found out about all this, to be honest. Long, strange story. Jesus. Anyway, I avoided her gaze. Anyway, I wanted to see what had been written about them. Could you print me a copy of that? Sure. And check for the other articles? She found all four of the stories that mentioned my birth parents. The next day, November 8th, 1979, a follow-up story had appeared. It divulged no new details on the police investigation, but the reporter had done some digging and learned that the Smiths had been college sweethearts in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and had been the parents of a 3-year-old daughter. No mention of her name or what had happened to her. What had happened to me. The third story had run the following Monday, November 12th, the day of the funeral. Several neighbors and family friends were quoted. But it was the photograph that made me gasp. A grainy but large photo, showing a young couple, arms around each other's waists, standing beside a backyard barbecue grill. The man had tongs in one hand and a grin on his face. He looked pleasant. I did not recognize him. But her. God, her. I felt the dizzying sensation of looking into a trick mirror, the kind you find in the dressing rooms of discount stores that reflect you either 10 pounds lighter or 10 pounds heavier than your true self, and distort your features just enough that you appear both recognizably yourself and disconcertingly foreign. Or perhaps that is too cryptic a description. The simple fact is, she looked just like me. Her hair was different, darker than mine and sculpted into Charlie's Angel's wings, which would have been the rage back then. She might have been a few inches shorter, too, although it was hard to tell. The eyes, though, the lips, the smile, identical. The curves, too, on display in a tube top and bell-bottom jeans. You could show this photo to any of my friends today, and at first glance their only question would be why I was dressed for a 70s theme party, and who was the guy beside me flipping burgers? I reached up and touched the screen. I've never seen them before, I whispered. She looks like you. Or I guess you look like her. You really do. I began to cry. Quietly at first, and then great wrenching sobs. I had perhaps not believed it until that moment. There is a difference between knowing something in your mind and knowing it in your heart. I had by now seen my original birth certificate, and the MRI, and the X-ray. But they had not packed the visceral punch of staring at a face nearly identical to my own. My mother. My flesh and blood. Undeniable. Her eyes smiling up at me for the first time in more than 30 years. Jessica hustled me into a conference room down the hall and brought coffee. It was scalding and carried the saccharine whiff of artificial sweetener, but I drank it anyway. I blew my nose on a paper napkin. You okay now? Yes. Sorry, I didn't intend to start blubbering. Don't be silly. I wasn't prepared for that photo. How could you be? How could anyone? I can't imagine. Jessica patted my leg and told me to sit tight for a minute. When she reappeared, she was carrying several printed sheets of paper, the archived articles. There was only one more, she handed them to me, from a few days after the funeral. Odds and ends about the investigation, how a suspect had been questioned and released. They don't give his name. And there's a little more about you. They don't give your name either. It just talks about how the daughter was injured in the shooting and how she was still recovering. I flipped through the stack. Maybe read them later? She asked gently. She had been gracious, but clearly she needed to get back to work.
Sure. It's just... it's not much, is it?
What do you mean?
Well, I know they weren't famous or rich or anything. But 4 short articles? That doesn't seem like much. Wouldn't this have been a pretty sensational crime? A handsome couple and their cute toddler shot in cold blood in their own home? In a nice neighborhood? I'm surprised there wasn't more coverage.
Jessica considered this.
Bear in mind, the police would have wanted to keep a lid on how much information they gave out. Anything that gets in the paper can tip off the perpetrator. That's always the way. Reporters tend to know a lot more than they're allowed to print. And look at the date.
She tapped a blue fingernail against the top printout. 1979. They were dealing with, like, 2 dozen murders a month back then. Atlanta was the murder capital of the country.
Really?
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. You must remember the Atlanta child murders. The bodies of children kept turning up in the woods, then in the river. Awful stuff. We did a big anniversary feature reminding people about it right after I started working here.
When was that?
She counted on her fingers.
4 years ago.
Right. And the story was pegged to the 30th anniversary.
So there you go. 1979.
She looked pleased with herself for figuring this out.
We dug up some unbelievable archive photos to run with that story. Totally gruesome. But it does help answer your question. The cops were probably overwhelmed. They would have had a massive backlog of cases, and the child murders were making national headlines. Investigators would have been focused on the kids. Maybe your parents got a little lost in the shuffle.
Maybe. I thought about this. You think the reporters covering crime might have been overwhelmed too? That would explain why there aren't many stories.
I guess. Who was it that covered your parents?
She reached for the articles.
Huh. Funny I didn't notice. I don't know her. She pointed at the byline on the first story, someone named Janice Fleming. But this one, Leland Brett, he's one of our managing editors.
What? You mean still?
He's worked here forever. Leland's probably upstairs on the 6th floor right now.
The newsroom was disconcertingly bright and modern. I wanted it to look the way the Washington Post does and All the President's Men, a warren of chipped desks, drowning under piles of paper and clattering typewriters and flasks of whiskey. A place where unshaven reporters plied their trade, weaseling news tips out of shady sources. The way newspapers are supposed to look. But the Journal Constitution newsroom could have passed for a travel agency, or a suburban bank. Cheerful blue and orange color scheme, glass internal walls, air on chairs. Everything looked sleek and sterile and anatomically correct. Everything except Leland Brett's office. He seemed to have missed the memo. His desk was parked in a ratty, stale-smelling corner. Ancient, pink, while-you-were-out phone messages scrawled in fading ink were taped 2 and 3 deep on the windows and glass walls, blocking out most natural light. Jessica had knocked and shoved me through his door with only the briefest of introductions. "She's a professor up at Georgetown. You wrote about her family ages ago." And then disappeared. I was left clutching the sheaf of papers and wondering where to begin. What exactly did I want to know from this man? Fortunately, he made a great show of politeness, ushering me in and pulling up a chair across from me. I resisted the urge to brush off the upholstery before taking a seat.
"So, what do we have here, pretty lady?"
Brett was short and puffy, with blonde hair that had thinned to just a few pale tuffets dotted across his scalp. He looked about 60. He adjusted reading glasses on his nose and reached for the articles, brushing his hand along my leg as he took them from me. "Pretty lady? And touching my thigh?" Surely they didn't still do things that way down in Georgia. Or maybe they did. I frowned and explained as succinctly as I could that my birth parents had been killed in Atlanta in 1979, that I had been adopted and had only just found out about the murders, and that he had written the original stories for the Journal Constitution.
"I would have written them for the Journal," he corrected me. "We didn't merge newsrooms until a few years after that. The Journal was the evening paper. The Constitution came out every morning. But let's see what you've got."
He scanned the first two articles with an air of concentration, then glanced up.
"I can't say I remember this. I've written a lot of murder stories over the years, sorry to say. You say these people were your folks?"
"Yes."
"Awful shame. What a pity."
He turned back to reading. When he got to the third story, the one with the photograph, something sparked in his eyes.
"You know, I think maybe I do remember them. Good-looking kids. They never caught the guy, did they?"
He ran his finger down the pages.
"That's right, that's right. They had a baby girl. I'm guessing that must have been you. Am I right?"
His gaze met mine and then wandered down appreciatively. Oh, dear. So the thigh brush had not been accidental. "It was me. Mr. Brett, would you have any idea how to reach these people you quoted? It looks like you interviewed a couple of neighbors, and also someone you identify as a close friend of Sadie Rawson Smith's. I'd love to talk to them."
"No idea."
He scratched his head, puffing up the blonde tufts until a clump of them stood on end.
"You could certainly check if the neighbors are still living in their same houses. And as for the friend, what was her name?"
I pointed to a quote in the third article, attributed to a woman named Cheryl Rooney.
"Cheryl Rooney. Nope. No, ma'am. Doesn't ring a bell."
"Might you still have old notes that you've kept? I suppose they would be on paper, not computer, from back then." He looked over at a cardboard box dumped in a corner, overflowing with small spiral-bound notebooks.
"I do keep them, but not as far back as that. We moved headquarters 3 years ago. I threw most everything out."
I was impressed, despite myself, that he'd managed to accumulate so much clutter in a mere 3 years. "What about the investigation itself? I'd love to get some insight into why the Smiths were killed. There's a cop quoted who suggests it might have been a burglary gone wrong.
Sounds likely. I don't recollect any whiff of their being mixed up in any trouble. Nothing that might have got them killed.
You talked to a cop who told you they brought a suspect in for questioning.
Did I?
I showed Brett the relevant paragraph. See, right here. But they let him go.
Well, they probably brought in lots of people for questioning. I honestly don't remember. And let me level with you. I was a kid then. I must have been, let's see, 24, 25 years old, covering general assignment stories, whatever the editors decided to throw at me that morning. I didn't have police sources. I swallowed whatever they told me and wrote it up.
But this commander you quoted, I searched the copy for the name, Steve Meadows, commander of the Atlanta Police Department Homicide Unit. You must have talked to him.
I'm sure I did, but that was 34 years ago. Who knows? It's possible I lifted that quote from a briefing or a press release. I wish I could tell you that I had a direct pipeline to the homicide chief. I really do. Not that it would have done me much good. The Atlanta PD was even more screwed up back in those days than it is now. Understaffed, same as today. The guys working homicide could barely keep their heads above water. Meadows, or whatever his name was, likely didn't have a damn clue who took out your parents.
That seemed a rather indelicate way of putting things, and I shot Brad a dirty look.
Sorry, but it's the truth.
I took a deep breath and willed myself to keep going. Your colleague, Jessica. I cocked my head back toward the newsroom. Jessica said reporters often know more than they're able to print.
She's right. But whatever I might have once known about this story, I've forgotten long ago. I'm sorry, sweetheart.
He leaned back and flicked his gaze up and down my legs again.
I'll tell you what, I'll have one of the interns look at this today, see if they can track down a phone number for one of those neighbors who used to know your mom and dad. And meanwhile, I've had a thought.
I waited.
What I'm thinking is, you're a great story in and of yourself. We could interview you, write up a profile about your coming back to Atlanta, coming home after all these years, trying to find out about your family. It could be a sweet little update.
I shook my head no.
Now, hang on, hear me out. There might be readers out there who remember your folks. Certainly, our older readers still remember that period in the city in general. Terrible time. Late 70s, early 80s. New murders rolling in every other day. It would be great if one of them turned out to have a happy ending after all this time.
A happy ending? My parents died.
True. My apologies. Didn't mean to sound disrespectful. But what I was fixing to say was that you turned out so well, after everything your family suffered. A college professor and a beauty to boot.
No, I said firmly.
We could talk about it over dinner.
No, thank you. I narrowed my eyes in a way intended to signal my refusal covered both the story proposal and the dinner invitation.
As you like. But think about it this way. Friends of the family might see the story and want to get in touch. Or old work colleagues of your dad's. Who knows who might be out there. If my interns don't turn up anything, it's your best shot at locating people who knew your parents.
He had a point. I pressed my lips together. Thanks for the offer. I'll think about it. I drove from the newsroom to the cemetery. The obituary that Leland Brett had written that ran the day of the funerals mentioned the burial location. Arlington Memorial Park was in a neighborhood called Sandy Springs, just a 10-minute drive from the newspaper. A pretty cemetery. Tasteful fountains, small landscaped lakes. If it weren't for all the mausoleums and marble, the place could have passed for an upscale golf course. I stopped at the front office, housed in a squat building inside the gates. "Hi," I greeted the woman behind the desk. "I'm trying to find a specific grave."
"Write the deceased's name down here," she said. "I'll see if anyone's free to do a location lookup."
5 minutes later, another woman appeared, wearing a black pantsuit and carrying a pink highlighted map. I reached out my hand for it.
"Did you drive?"
The second woman had a harsh nasal accent. New York, maybe, or New Jersey. "I did, yes."
"Easier if you just follow me, then. The sections aren't well marked. People get lost. Drive around for an hour looking. I was ready for a smoke break anyway."
I hopped back in my Mazda rental car and followed. She led for 5 minutes along smooth paved roads lined with pine and magnolia trees. Birdsong came to me. A pair of robins flitted between our cars. Eventually, she pulled over and rolled down her window.
"Should be right over there."
She pointed down one of several rows marked by small circular stones set flush in the ground.
"Want me to get out and find it with you?"
"No, I'll be fine. Thanks. Thanks very much." The day had warmed up considerably since I'd left my hotel this morning. An unseasonably mild breeze ruffled my hair as I climbed out of the car. Bright sunshine glinted off the asphalt. I shed my jacket, unwound my scarf, and threw them both on the front seat. I picked up the roses I had purchased en route and started walking. Their graves, when I found them, were modest but well-kept. Boone and Sadie Rossensmith were buried side by side under a single granite marker. It listed their names, dates of birth, and dates of death. Nothing else. No epitaph. I crouched down and ran my fingers over the lettering. I'd asked the florist to tie together 2 dozen white roses with a pink satin ribbon. Pink for the little girl who had loved this couple once, who had taken 3 decades to find her way back to their side. I laid the flowers on the grass and stood back. I had expected this to be the toughest moment in my journey to Atlanta. I had expected to weep. But I was all cried out from my morning in the newsroom. Instead, I felt empty, and suddenly, embarrassingly, hungry. My stomach growled. I stood around a bit longer, waiting to be felled by overwhelming emotion. It didn't happen. The photograph of my mother's face had hit me harder than this sunny, peaceful spot. Within a few minutes, I felt ready to leave. I touched my fingers to my lips, and then spread them one last time across the cool stone where my parents' names were carved. If it was closure I was looking for in Atlanta, I wouldn't find it here. 12. Leland Brett called my mobile just as I was stepping back into my hotel. I'd booked a room at the St. Regis, an imposingly posh establishment that far exceeded my usual travel budget. The clientele was mostly expense account types, business travelers who glided through the lobby wearing bespoke suits and brandishing platinum Amex cards. But I was justifying the indulgence on the grounds that I'd suffered a terrible shock, and therefore deserved a little pampering. I was spending my waking hours performing mournful chores, visiting graves and poring over obituaries. The only thing keeping me going was the prospect of returning in the evening to a good hotel with high thread count sheets. Leland caught me as I handed the rental car key to a valet and pushed through the front doors. I leaned against the wall by the elevators, pressed the phone to my ear, and listened as he made his pitch.
"More I think about it, more I love the idea of telling your story for our readers," he drawled. "And it's a grand opportunity for you, too. What about I swing by after work, buy you a drink, and we can ponder it further? Where are you staying?"
The man was persistent. You had to give him that. No doubt a valuable quality in a reporter. but sipping cocktails across from him while he accidentally pressed his leg against mine under the table was the last thing I felt like doing. "I'd love to," I lied, "but I have plans tonight." Another lie. "And I'm leaning against this whole profile idea." That, at least, was the truth.
"Well, that's a shame. But while you cogitate on it, here's a little favor I've done for you. I've found you a phone number for Cheryl Rooney, your mama's friend. Turns out she still lives in town. She's a teacher, retired from one of the big private schools. Got a pen handy?"
He read out a home phone number and an address.
"I reckon if I were to ask the interns to keep working on this, they maybe could find numbers for other folks. Other old neighbors and family friends and whatnot. And of course, there's no way of knowing who might come forward if we were to run a story about you."
He paused, then blew out a soft, low whistle.
"No siree, just can't know until you try."
The rat. This was blatant and despicable manipulation. What made it even more annoying was that he was right. "What exactly would you need from me?" I asked warily. After that, he knew he had me. I did hold steadfast in my refusal to meet him tonight. But he talked me into having breakfast with him in the morning at 8, at the hotel restaurant. The interview would take an hour.
"One other arrangement we ought to iron out," he said. "We'll need a picture of you. The staff photographers will want to do it at the golden hour. That's right before sunset, the best light. Let's take it in front of your parents' old house. Where was that again?"
"Eulalia Road, near Lenox." I was learning the lingo of Atlanta neighborhoods. Lenox Square was a huge shopping mall that everyone seemed to know.
"Wonderful. What's the house number? We'll need to call the current owners. Let them know what we're up to."
"Oh, it's a Mrs. Dorminey. I met her yesterday. She gave me a tour."
"Did she? So she already knows who you are. Hopefully she won't mind a staff photag taking a few snaps with her house's backdrop. Technically, mind you, we can shoot from the street, never set a foot on her property, but it never hurts to be courteous."
"Are you sure you need my picture, though?"
"My dear, your picture is going to be the best thing about this story. The caption practically writes itself. Dark beauty haunted by tragedy. Readers will eat it up. Now you have a good night, and I'll see you in the morning."
13. I pause here to mention the state of my wrist and neck. Nothing is more tiresome than listening to people go on about their medical woes, so I've spared you the minute-by-minute updates. Suffice to say that my wrist hurt, nearly all the time. I had come, though, to feel it as a sort of background noise, a chronic nuisance that I was learning to work around. You can learn to live with almost anything, I suppose. Driving with one hand was easy, shampooing less so. Cutting steak or anything else requiring a knife and fork wasn't pretty, though it could be done. The one thing I could not manage with one hand was typing. But here I had apparently gotten lucky. Typing, the very activity that provokes the carpal tunnel symptoms of most sufferers, did not bother me in the least. I could type all day without a twinge. As for my neck, it had stopped hurting. No, that's not quite right. It hadn't stopped hurting, but the hot pulsing had retreated, like a wild animal that has tired and decided for now to rest. The important thing was to keep still. The pain nipped when I turned my head, especially to the right. So I learned not to do this. If I needed to glance sideways, I swiveled my whole torso. I probably looked like a geriatric constrained by an invisible neck brace, but it helped. My most pressing physical complaint, late on that Tuesday afternoon, was that I was ravenous. 5 days without a proper meal had proved my limit. I dialed room service and ordered enough food to feed a family of four. Then I sat back to make a few phone calls. First, my mother. I knew instinctively that it would crush her to learn that Sadie Rawson Smith could have passed for my sister. I didn't think my mother would feel jealous, exactly. More left out, excluded. So I glossed over my newsroom visit and focused instead on the cemetery. How pretty it had been. How peaceful. I told Mom about laying the flowers and running my fingers over the granite names. She offered, for the 100th time, to fly down to be with me. "Just to keep you company," she pleaded. My sweet Mom. It was tempting to say yes. But she would slow me down, and this pilgrimage felt like something I needed to do on my own. I assured her that I was fine. I would wrap up here tomorrow, I told her, and probably fly back to Washington on Thursday morning. Next, I left a message for Martin. Finally, I steeled myself and dialed the number that Leland had produced for Cheryl Rooney. Again, no answer. Just a recording of a pleasant-sounding man's voice telling me to leave a message for Rick and Cheryl. Lord, where to begin? I hung up, thought for a moment, then called back and left a short message stating my name, phone number, and that the matter was in regard to an old friend of hers. When the room service trolley arrived, I asked the waiter to set everything out on the coffee table. He did so, along with two starched napkins and two sets of cutlery, having quite reasonably assumed that I couldn't be planning to eat all this myself. It was a ridiculous spread. Caesar salad, tomato and basil soup, fresh fruit, a basket of warm rolls, a side of fries, a slice of pie, and a cheeseburger. To be precise, a glorious bacon double cheeseburger, dripping with mustard and grease. I wolfed it down and wished I'd ordered a second. Instead, I contented myself with polishing off the rest of the food. It was delicious. Not a single bite tasted like cardboard. Does it sound callous to eat with such gusto given recent events? Given the bleak reason for my mission to Atlanta? It felt that way. As though I were being disrespectful. I pulled out the photograph that Jessica had printed for me and studied it. My birth parents looked so happy, laughing and flipping burgers on the grill. The sun was beating down on them, and she appeared to be batting smoke out of her eyes. On a table behind them, you could make out jars of mustard and mayonnaise, a platter of buns. All of a sudden, I broke into a grin. This must have been why I'd been craving a cheeseburger all day. I'd seen the photograph this morning, and the suggestion of flame-grilled beef had insinuated itself somewhere in my subconscious. It was funny, now that I thought about it. But we Cashins never made burgers when I was growing up. Tony and Martin preferred steak or barbecued chicken, hands down. Mom did too, and Dad is a casserole man. But Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith had apparently liked a good quarter pounder, and they'd passed on the taste to their only daughter. It was such a silly thing, but I felt a connection to them. Zinging back over the decades and the loss and all the things that might have been, I decided that if they could see me now, licking grease off my fingers, they wouldn't find it disrespectful. No, they'd want me to eat a burger or two for them. I was still smiling to myself an hour later when I crawled into bed and fell into a deep sleep, snuggled beneath the high thread count sheets. 14. Wednesday, October 16th, 2013. It was on Wednesday that things began to happen fast. Leland Brett showed up for breakfast right on time, and to give him his due, he conducted a detailed and thorough interview. He asked me to bring along a copy of my adoption papers, proving that I really had once been Caroline Smith, daughter of Boone and Sadie Rawson. He studied this until he seemed satisfied, then questioned me about my work, my hobbies, my family up in Washington. What sports did I like? None. What kind of music did I listen to? Classical, hip-hop, Aerosmith. Everything, really, except country. Leland had done his homework, reading up on me on the university website. He wanted to know how I'd learned French and how often I made it to Paris. I got the sense he was warming me up, pitching softball questions, waiting for me to relax and drop my guard before he broached the real subject at hand. When the food arrived, we hadn't yet touched on the events of 1979. Incredibly, I was starving again. I'd ordered the signature sweet potato pancakes, served with hot bourbon sauce, candied pecans, and a side of sausage. Leland looked impressed.
I see you've got a healthy appetite.
He eyed both me and my pancakes hungrily.
I like that in a woman.
God, here we went again. I frowned. Leland, in case I've somehow given you the wrong impression, I should make clear, this is a business meeting, okay? I'm here to help with the article. Period. He feigned innocence.
Well, of course. And I'm just here doing my job, which at the moment includes enjoying breakfast with a fine-looking woman. That's no crime, is it?
No, I agreed through gritted teeth.
But that does make a good segue. You married?
For God's sake.
For the story, that's why I'm asking.
I was about to push back my chair and walk out when he chuckled.
Calm down, hon. I don't bite. Just having a little fun with you. A little bit of fun. Otherwise, this whole business is downright morbid. You have to agree.
It's morbid whether I agree or not, I snapped.
That is the truth. Now, have yourself a bite of those pancakes, and then I want you to tell me about why you decided to come back to Atlanta now, after all these years.
I glared at him, but complied. He looked surprised to hear that I'd only recently learned my birth parents had been murdered.
But what did you think had happened to them? Car crash or something?
No, you misunderstand. I'd never heard of them. I didn't know I was adopted.
Good Lord in heaven. Your parents, the Cashins, I mean, they never told you?
No, they thought it best, how did Dad put it, best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'd never heard of Boone and Sadie Rawson Smith before last Thursday. Leland opened his eyes wide in astonishment. It's been something of a shock.
I should think so.
He shook his head.
Imagine that. Did they say why they chose to tell you now?
I'd known we would end up here. We'd been tiptoeing around the bullet this whole conversation. Leland Brett just hadn't known it. I felt uncomfortable talking about my neck. I don't like being the center of attention at the best of times. And the thought that everything I confided now would end up printed in the newspaper, it was enough to give even a more extroverted person pause. But hell, we'd come this far. And going public did seem my best chance to connect with people who had once known my family. So I told Leland about the carpal tunnel in my wrist, about getting an MRI, and finally about what the X-ray had shown. He dropped his fork.
You're not saying it's still in there.
I nodded.
A bullet.
A bullet?
From the day your parents were shot?
I nodded again. Apparently, it's been in there all this time. 34 years. It never bothered me. There's no scar.
Christ almighty. He was scribbling furiously in his notebook. You're sure? You have a copy of that X-ray?
On my phone, if you need to see it.
Christ almighty. He repeated. That's the craziest story I ever heard, and I've heard a few.
He was firing questions at me, trying to reconstruct the exact sequence of how I'd learned about the bullet when my phone rang. I squinted down. Will Zartman, calling from his office. He would be trying to firm up the appointment with that neurosurgeon. I sent the call to voicemail. I'd call him later. I turned back to Leland. Sorry, where were we?
I was saying, I've got a few more questions. Why don't I give you a ride over to the newsroom? We can finish up there and...
Can't. I'm going over to Cheryl Rooney's after this.
Oh, so that phone number worked.
Mm-hmm. She called me back this morning, right before I came down to meet you. I don't think she could get her head around what I was telling her. Poor woman. She sounded even more stunned by all this than you are.
My God. You're so like her.
Same eyes. There's not an ounce of Boone in you. Cheryl Rooney sat studying me across her living room. She had given me directions to her home, a compact gray stucco house that backed up to the Chattahoochee River.
I was going to ask you for ID before I let you in. There's a lot of crazies in the world. But when I saw you walking up the driveway, I realized no need. Like watching Sadie Rawson herself walk through my front door.
You knew them both, then? Both my birth parents.
Your birth parents?
She cocked her head.
Yes, I suppose that's how you would think of them. But look at me, I've forgotten my manners. Would you care for coffee?
No, thank you.
Are you sure? I've just brewed a pot.
I'm not much of a coffee drinker, but I'd love some tea, if it's not too much trouble. She bustled off and returned a few minutes later, carrying a tray. It held a plate of cookies, a mug of steaming coffee, and a tall crystal goblet filled with ice and pale brown liquid. I took a cautious sip. Iced tea. I'd heard this, how Southerners remain loyal to cold tea no matter how chilly the weather outside. I set down my glass and met her eyes. The newspaper identified you as a close friend of my birth, of my mother's. How did you know her?
We lived in the house next door. Moved there in 74 and stayed more than 20 years, until we bought this.
She swept her hand to indicate the room where we were sitting.
Eulalia was a great street for young families. Starter homes, you know. Although too expensive for that now. Did you know a house down on the Lenox End just sold for $1.6 million? Incredible. We paid $55,000 when we first bought.
I shook my head. It's a lovely street. So you were already living there when the Smiths moved in?
We were. We were glad to get a nice young couple next door. The four of us got to be good friends. And then, when John and you came along, your mother and I spent nearly every morning together.
I tried to follow this. John is your son? She pointed at a framed photograph on a side table beside the sofa. It showed a pudgy man in a golf shirt and khakis.
My oldest. You were older than him, but only by a couple of months. You and he were great pals as toddlers. You don't remember him?
I'm afraid I don't remember anything from those years.
The two of you used to play together in a playpen we would set up in the kitchen and fill with balls and toys. Sadie Rawson and I would drink coffee and bake together. That girl could burn things, I tell you. She had a true talent for it. She'd roll out dough and pop it in the oven, get to talking and forget all about it. Next thing you know, your kitchen was filled with smoke.
Cheryl smiled.
And we went for walks, endless walks. There wasn't much to do back then when you stayed home with a baby. None of these play groups and gymboree classes that young mothers do today.
I was hanging on her every word. What was she like? I mean, was she quiet or funny or...
Funny, yes. And about as far from quiet as a person can get. She was the life of the party. Boone was the serious, steady one. They played off each other. I guess all couples do.
Sounds like I take after my father.
Not in the looks department, you don't.
It's incredible how you favor her. She was a pretty, pretty girl. Bedroom eyes and shiny lip glossy lips. We'd be out pushing baby strollers, just walking around the block in our house dresses, and you'd see the men's heads snap when they drove past. Sades would just laugh and wave. A cloud passed over Cheryl's face. She was no beauty. Didn't look as if she had ever been. Late middle age had scored her mouth with dry lines, and her hair was bleached and brittle. But surely that wasn't jealousy, I detected. Not after all these years. She sounds like she must have been a handful. I thought so. I thought she must have been feisty, keeping her maiden name and all. Cheryl looked confused.
No, she went by Smith.
Right, but Sadie Rawson Smith, like Hillary Rodham Clinton. That must have been progressive for Georgia in the 1970s.
No, it wasn't a Hillary Rodham thing. Sadie Rawson was her first name. You know, like Mary Bell or Georgia Ruth. Lots of girls down here use double-barreled names. Still do.
Oh, quite a mouthful. She shrugged.
Sadie Rawson has the same number of syllables as Elizabeth, if you think about it. And nobody thinks that's too long a name.
We fell silent.
It must be very upsetting for you, she ventured after a bit, learning about all this now.
I'd told her the broad outlines of what I knew and when I'd come to know it, on the phone this morning. I left out the bullet details.
It's been strange. It's good to meet you, though. I love hearing what the Smiths were like. My parents, the Cashins, don't seem to know much, and the newspaper accounts about what happened are pretty bare bones. The paper ran four stories, and then it seemed to fall off the radar.
She nodded.
The police must have talked to you. Did they ever let anything slip? I mean, could you tell if they ever had a good lead?
They interviewed us twice, Rick and me. We hadn't heard or seen anything out of the ordinary that day. We told them everything we could. To be honest, I wasn't that impressed with the efforts of the Atlanta police. They were convinced from day one that it must have been a burglar who got surprised by your parents and started shooting. But they never did catch him.
I don't understand how that happens. A burglar breaks in, kills two people, and the police just let it drop.
Well, it was an unusual case. No physical evidence, at least not that I could gather. There weren't any fingerprints in the house that weren't supposed to be there, and they never found a murder weapon. All they had was an eyewitness.
There was an eyewitness?
Of course, honey. You.
15. Before I left, Cheryl Rooney pressed a pair of gold earrings into my hands.
They were your mom's. Only thing I have of hers. They've been sitting in my jewelry box all these years. I never could bring myself to wear them.
The earrings were enormous, finely braided hoops. They had a vaguely gypsy quality to them, delicate and gaudy at once. Not the kind of thing I would ever wear. But then, I hadn't been a fashionable young woman in the 1970s.
They were the height of fashion back then, said Cheryl, reading my mind. I borrowed them to wear to a party. Only reason I have them.
After your parents died, the whole house was a crime scene. Police tape everywhere. I wasn't allowed in to try to scoop up anything else of hers. Then one day, movers appeared, boxed everything up, and the house was sold.
Thank you for keeping these.
She had beautiful jewelry and clothes. With her figure, she could wear anything. She had this green coat, so chic, with matching green suede boots.
Cheryl smiled sadly.
You'd have loved her taste.
I nodded.
I would have come to visit you. I would have liked to stay in touch. Your mother would have wanted that. But afterwards, the doctors wouldn't let me see you. You were in intensive care for weeks. And I assume the police were trying to question you during that time.
Do you know if I saw anything? Was I able to tell them anything that helped? She shook her head.
I've no idea. You don't remember?
No, not anything.
Probably for the best. You were a baby, Caroline. Barely more than a baby. I didn't mean to suggest otherwise when I said that about you being an eyewitness. Who knows what you saw or didn't?
She patted my shoulder.
Anyway, after a time, the social services must have gotten involved. Next thing I heard, you'd been adopted by a new family. We never had word again. It was like you'd just been spirited away. I hope they were kind to you, the couple that adopted you, I mean.
Very kind. I felt my voice tighten with love. The kindest family ever. I couldn't have asked for a more loving home.
I'm glad.
Cheryl touched my shoulder again.
Mercy, it's brought back some memories seeing you. To think that you're older now than Sadie Rawson and Boone when they died. Such a nice man, your daddy. Didn't deserve what he got.
Neither of them did. She blinked, then nodded. Tears were in her eyes as she closed the door. Tears and something else. A hint of jealousy again? Or some other emotion? I couldn't tell, could only sense it twitching, a sour undercurrent beneath the surface. Something Cheryl Rooney had said was nagging at me. Some detail didn't sit right. I couldn't put my finger on it, and the more I tried to catch it, the more it eluded me, like a kitten batting at a piece of yarn. I was parked back on Eulalia Road for my appointment with the Journal Constitution photographer. I was not looking forward to it. Was already regretting my decision to participate in this entire exercise. It felt tacky, as though I were exploiting a long-ago tragedy to seize 15 minutes of fame. That was the farthest thing from the truth. But still, people would judge. I pulled out a compact and reapplied my lipstick. My brothers would have something to say if they could see me sitting here, primping for pictures to accompany the presumably breathless article that Leland Brett would be typing up right now. Dark beauty still distressed by bullet in neck. The only question was whether Martin and Tony would be appalled or doubled over with laughter. I glanced at my watch. The photographer was late. He had insisted we meet at 5 o'clock, to get set up and plenty of time for the golden hour light. I decided to wait another 15 minutes, then I was out of here. A few cars rumbled by. Across the street, two boys kicked a ball back and forth in their yard. The smaller boy kept missing and sending the ball rolling dangerously close to the street. The older one managed to pounce and catch it each time, just before it bounced over the curb. I leaned back in the front seat and imagined a young Cheryl Rooney and my mother pushing baby strollers along this same block on a late afternoon stroll. What would they have chatted about? I pictured Sadie Rawson wearing the sassy green coat and suede boots that Cheryl had described. Now, those I would have liked to inherit. I sat up. That was it. Where had they gone? The coat, the boots, the allegedly fabulous wardrobe. Cheryl said everything had been boxed up and carted away, but to where? The clothes must have been donated to charity long ago. Books and knick-knacks, too. That left my mother's jewelry, though. I fingered the gold braided hoops, wondered what necklaces and bracelets she used to slip on to match. Now that I thought about it, where were my parents' wedding rings? Had they been buried in them? Or had everything been sold off? They must have had a car. They might have had life insurance. My thoughts raced along these lines for several minutes before my gaze swung toward the brick house in front of me. This house had once belonged to Boone and Sadie Rawson. Where had the money gone when it was sold? The question of an inheritance had not crossed my mind before. There was no indication the Smiths had been rich, and in any case, I wasn't hurting for money. Still, normal married people write wills leaving everything to each other. Failing that, they leave everything to their surviving children. I was the Smiths' surviving daughter. So how must things have unfolded? What on earth happens when a couple is murdered, and their heir is 3 years old, and she ends up being raised with no contact with her past, not even the same last name? I had no idea how one might go about tracing such things, but I knew someone who might. Jessica Yao, the newspaper researcher. Her job was to help track down information and people. Plus, she knew Atlanta. I picked up my phone and dialed.
"That is so bizarre," she answered. "I was about to call you. Literally, I was about to pick up the phone, and here your number shows up on my caller ID. Since I've got you now, is it Franny with an IE or with a Y?"
"Sorry, what?"
"Your mom, Mrs. Cashin, does she spell it F-R-A-N-N?
Oh, with IE. Why are you..."
"Leland's got me fact-checking your profile."
Clicking sounds came down the phone line. I pictured her blue fingernails flying over the keyboard.
"It's also kind of confusing, the way he's written the section about the bullet. Did you get the MRI first or the X-ray?"
"The MRI, but listen..."
"I knew it," she chirped. "You would think he could get the details straight. He was probably too busy ogling your chest to pay attention to the chronology."
That stopped me short.
"Wow. Sorry. I didn't just say that. He is my boss, technically, but you are a woman and you're alive, which pretty much qualifies you as fair game in Leland's world. Damn it. I didn't just say that either."
He must be an interesting guy to work for." The typing ceased.
"He didn't really put the moves on you, did he? Not when he was interviewing you for a news story."
"He did, in a harmless kind of way."
"The bastard. His poor wife, but that's exactly right. Leland's so obviously harmless that it's hard to get too riled up."
The clicking resumed.
"Just a couple more questions. Did he get right that you haven't been back to Atlanta to visit any time between 1979 and now?"
"That's right. Hang on, though. I've got a question for you. Is there a way to figure out what my birth parents' social security numbers would have been?"
"I'm sure there must be. Why?"
"I'm sitting here, parked in front of their old house, waiting for your photographer, who's late, by the way, and it occurs to me that the Smiths used to own this house. When they died, it must have been sold, and I have no idea where the money went."
"Oh," Jessica sounded intrigued. "I like it. You think there's some nest egg out there with your name on it that's been racking up interest all these years.
I'm not asking out of greediness. I'm mainly interested in where their possessions went. You know, if there's a chance of getting back any personal items that might be meaningful."
"Sure, sure. You could check the property deeds, see who sold the house on behalf of your parents. Fulton County would keep those records, I think."
"I hadn't thought of that. Do you know how to access them?"
"Yep. Tell you what, let me finish up this article for Leland. First thing tomorrow, I'll nose around for you."
I exhaled. "That would be terrific. I'll pay you for your time, and I'd be grateful if you could keep this between us for now. No need to mention it to Leland."
"No problem.
Let's see what I turn up. It'll be interesting. Very Watergate.
Watergate?
You know, follow the money.
Will Zartman was livid by the time he reached me. Don't you ever answer your phone? He demanded. Or is it just my calls that you ignore?
I'm not ignoring you. I've been running around all day, and I was going to call you back tonight.
I've left two messages, Caroline. I was getting worried that something had happened to you.
I'm fine. Totally fine.
No, actually, you're not. That's why I've been trying to reach you. Part of why I've been trying to reach you.
He cleared his throat.
I set things up with Dr. Gellert, the neurosurgeon. He can squeeze you in Friday afternoon. That works, right? You're still flying back to D.C. tomorrow?
Absolutely.
Good. I also showed your X-ray and MRI to an orthopedic surgeon, an old friend of mine from med school. He agreed that your original doctors must have decided against removing the bullet because it was jammed so tight in there, against so many important nerves.
Makes sense.
But his question was, what if the bullet has shifted? He thinks your wrist pain is almost certainly related, and that didn't start until a few months ago, which means something is pressing down in a way that it didn't used to. Do you have a family history of osteoporosis?
Well, for God's sake, you of all people should know I have no idea what my family medical history is.
He sucked in his breath. Of course. Sorry. The reason I ask is as we age, our bodies change. The spine compresses. Most people lose about half an inch in height every decade. That begins in our late 30s. How old are you exactly?
Not old enough for my spine to be buckling, thank you very much.
I can pull your chart if you prefer.
37, I said disagreeably.
So you're on the young side, but that's around when it starts. Think of your discs as jelly-filled pads between your vertebrae. Over the years, they lose fluid and flatten out, like a house settling on its foundation.
Oh, that's a lovely image. My body, a collapsing old house.
That's not what I meant. Your body is a lot of things, but old and collapsing would not be the words that spring to mind.
I absorbed that. My face felt hot. I was blushing.
That was inappropriate, he said after a long moment. I apologize. I don't know what came over me.
He cleared his throat again, more ferociously this time.
I've lost my train of thought. Oh, yes. My point was that if your spine has compressed even by a millimeter, that's a problem. We need to jump on it. My med school buddy suggested you get a 360-degree X-ray taken to give us a better idea what's going on. What time does your flight get in tomorrow?
I'm not sure yet. I need to sort out my reservation tonight.
Did you actually have a ticket booked?
He asked suspiciously. Yes, but I paid for a flexible fare. I wasn't sure how long I would want down here.
Would you email me your itinerary once you nail it down?
Why?
It was my turn to sound suspicious. Because, Caroline, retorted Will, we're not messing around here. There's a piece of metal buried in your neck.